Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. We have an awful lot to talk about this week. It's going to be an exciting week with, plenty of interesting discussions. Nia, Nintendo Switch, the works. With me this week, we have Matt.
Hello.
And Ginny.
Hi.
I'm a little bit outnumbered this week. There's more New Zealanders than Australians. This is a problem. Hatsune Miku track, just to put everyone in a really good mood before we get talking about the serious stuff. So we can talk about it now. Embargo has lifted. Nier Automata, that's obviously a game that the relatively few people that played the first one were really looking forward to, and thanks to the reputation that that first one had, a lot of people who never played it were really looking forward to it as well. And yeah, it's come out and it has basically met every expectation that any of us have ever had. And my review, you can go and have a read of it, but basically I've called it the best game of all time, which is a big call, but I'm sticking by it because it is. And Matt, you've been playing it as well, as somebody who hasn't played the original Nier. What did you think of it?
So I am one of those people you mentioned who I've never played Nier or Drakengard or any of those, but I've been excited about Nier Automata just based on things I've read about the original Nier and mostly stuff you've written, Matt, I think. You made me excited about a game that I probably would never have played otherwise. But yeah, I am really, really enjoying it. I'm still playing through it. I'm on my second playthrough of, in typical Nier fashion, you have to complete it a few times with to get the different endings and all the way the story layers on top of each other. So I'm kind of going through my second playthrough and it's blowing my mind. Just the amount of depth and the things that it makes you think about, and probably even stuff that it was not intended, but just because of how much depth there is in little things, it kind of almost primes you to start being like, what is the meaning of this thing that happened, which was probably just a bug that I broke the game.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's like the director of Nier, the creative guy, the mad genius behind it all, Yoko Taro, he insists black and blue that he doesn't really think about his games to the kind of depth that some people, i.e. me, attribute them to him. But when you're playing it, it's just impossible to imagine that he doesn't think about his games on a very deep level. So yeah, it's weird that he doesn't claim to think about them so much. If he doesn't, then he is just an beyond unbelievably genius, because it just comes so naturally to him. But yeah, I for me, the thing about Nier has always been, and Drakengard as well, has always been not so much the gameplay, although the gameplay in this one is brilliant thanks to Platinum Games. But it's always been the storytelling, and the concepts that kind of run behind that storytelling. Most games, unfortunately, I will say most, don't really have a second layer beneath the kind of the surface story. Or if they do, it's kind of very shallow and poorly developed. Nier is one of the few that really delve deep, and what you see on the surface is kind of only the start of what you need to think about to kind of really get what the game's talking about. And I know you haven't played Nier Automata yet, Ginny, but you're a big fan of the original Nier. I assume that you are looking forward to giving Automata a go at some stage.
Yep, I am definitely going to no life my way through Automata as soon as I can. So yeah, I mean, I guess coming from the opposite, I wouldn't say perspective, but from the position of Matt, where I haven't played the new one yet, but I've played the old ones, and I mean, I guess all I can do is really look forward to, I don't know, more of the same. Like, I think that the Nier series and Drakengard, they're unique in the sense that if you took the games at face value, I would say, because they have so many branching off endings for each game. If you took the games at face value, sort of set them out on like a table and sort of gave someone like a plot summary, they would seem almost difficult to relate in a sense. Like, they would look like they were just sort of separate snapshots from like different universes entirely. But I think what you notice is the more of the Nier and the more of the Drakengard games that you play, is that there's so much interplay between them and the titles that you wouldn't notice, I guess, maybe the first time playing it, or when I first played Drakengard when I was quite a bit younger. I didn't really, I don't think my brain was developed enough to sort of realize what was going on. I was like, oh, all this wild stuff is happening. This is really dope. But definitely, I think as the audience and the player base for Nier has matured and for Drakengard has matured over the years, I think you can definitely see that I would, I think I subscribe to the theory that Yoko Taro is like a mad genius. I'm just gonna put it out there right now. But I definitely feel like unless he sort of planned these plot lines from the very beginning, from like the very first Dragon Guard onwards, like there is no way that someone, you know, like the way that all these stories they play together so well, they've all got a narrative thread that links them all, no matter how crazy it sounds. And I just think that Yoko Taro is, I think, up there in terms of storytellers. And this might be like a discussion for like another day, but I think that the Dragon Guard and Nier games really know how to tell you a story and sell you a story. So I'm looking forward to that in Automata for sure.
Yep, I think I would, based solely on my experience with Automata, I would definitely agree with that. Everything you've just said, Yoko Taro is a mad genius. The storytelling is phenomenal, and yeah, just this, I think, I really hope that Square Enix does see the sense to find some way to re-release not just Nier, but all the Dragon Guard games, really. Not just for those story threads and being able to for I think there'll be a lot of people who are new, who are coming brand new into Automata, and having those story threads would be a way to experience those story threads would be really good. But also just yeah, from playing the game and being able to understand the kind of what people talk mean when they say that Yoko Taro is a mad genius, it just makes me want to play everything that he's ever made.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think, I mean, Square Enix has got no excuse not to re-release those games on PlayStation 4 in some format or other. If they can do that with, you know, Star Ocean 3, which was a PlayStation 2 game, obviously, they can do the HD, you know, upscaling thing to put PS2 games on PS4 for Dragon Guard and Dragon Guard 2. And I can't, it just boggles the mind that they didn't see the wisdom in doing a HD version of Nier, at least, if not Dragon Guard 3 as well, for the PlayStation 4 in the lead up to Nier Automata. I don't think you have to play those previous games to get what he's talking about in Nier Automata. It is enough of a break from the previous games, but the references in there to previous games are strong enough that you can get an extra kick out of it if you have that back knowledge. And yes, to kind of Ginny's point, I agree that like Yoko Taro, as a kind of mad genius, has managed to create this world over a number of games that the kind of the whole is stronger than each individual game in terms of storytelling. And I must admit, when I started to play the Dragon Guard games, I was fairly new to this whole philosophy stuff as well. So it was all just kind of blowing my mind. I was all just like, you know, what kind of drugs is this guy on and how do I get some? But yeah, as I started to read more about the philosophy stuff, and we'll talk about this a bit more in the next section as well. But yeah, as I started to get a better understanding of the kind of concepts that are clearly behind his games, they all started to make a lot more sense. One of the things that always kind of bugs me about the way people write and talk about Nier and Yoko Taro games is that they're, you know, they're always chalked up as being weird or odd or something, and they're not really. They make a lot of sense. If you understand what he's talking about, if you understand what he's on about, they make a lot of sense. And they're not weird. They're just dealing with some very complex storytelling issues and kind of philosophical issues and themes. And the only way you can kind of deal with those is being quite dense. And that kinds of, and I can get that that comes across as weird to people who might not just be as familiar with that stuff. But yeah, perhaps people should read more philosophy books, is my thinking.
Yeah, that is, I think that's definitely true. And there are a lot of moments in Automata that, taken at isolation, if you just saw that scene without the context of the game, would just be very, very weird, wouldn't even begin to cover it. But within the context of the game, everything kind of makes sense, even when it doesn't. If that makes sense, in a weird way. But I think the other important thing to mention is that, as dense as it is and as deep and philosophical it is, it's also very funny and self-aware. There's a lot of humor in it, and
Jean-Paul,
yes. there is as mentioned in Matt's review, there's an entire side quest line based around a character based on Jean-Paul Sartre, and the whole thing is making a joke at how annoying these philosophers are to actually deal with and talk to. And there's just that kind of stuff throughout the whole game. It's very funny and entertaining, as well as deep, and not even switching between the two. It does all these things at the same time with very little, just quite organically incorporates all these different elements into one.
And it plays really well. And that needs to be said, because a lot of people don't think Yoko Taro's previous games played particularly well. And to be fair, compared to kind of the great examples of the JRPG genre, they don't. But this one is genuinely right up there with, you know, the kind of the best playing games that you can find. Platinum Games knows their stuff about action. And really, that's probably Yoko Taro's one weakness. Is he doesn't really understand how to direct gameplay, I don't think. Mm. And he's had the team backing him for this one to really do that. So the good news is, finally, it looks like he's got a commercial hit. All of his other games have been bombs. But this one sold something like 200,000 copies in Japan on, you know, release week, which is quite strong. Sold the PlayStation 4 managed to sell a bunch of units thanks to this game. And yeah, that gives me hope that he's going to continue to find work. He surely must have been running out of, if he was going to continue to produce bombs, he was surely going to run out of lives with Square Enix, especially since Square Enix has been the one to produce all these bombs for him. So it's good that, you know, everybody who's backed this project has finally, or has backed Yoko Taro over the years, has finally been rewarded for it, I've got to say.
Yeah, I definitely think it's one of, at the very least, one of the best games on PlayStation 4. And if you have a PlayStation 4, you need to buy it. Like, whoever you are, whatever, whether or not you like JRPGs, whether or not you like Japanese games in general. And yeah, I would, probably one of the best games of all time.
Damn.
And even if you don't play it, get the soundtrack.
Yes.
Because holy crap, is that music good? Like, Nier had good music. Nier had great music. This one just, it'll completely blow your mind. Just get the soundtrack and listen to it. And welcome back. Hope you enjoyed that music. It was from Nier, just to prove how good it is. So for the second little section of our podcast this week, we thought we'd have a look at a topic that's near and dear to the three of us. And it's kind of, it has to do with games pulling influence from other art forms. Because as good as it is, I mean, as artful as games can be in themselves, one of the things that kind of defines a lot of the games we really love is when they draw on inspiration or pull elements of design or construction or thinking around other forms of art into the game itself. Obviously, you know, we're talking about literature, we're talking about artistic, you know, paintings, concepts, art movements there. And then, you know, we're just starting to see some of the more creative developers experiment with even odder art forms for games. There's been one or two examples of games that have pulled inspiration from opera, for example, and one or two games, or one game, that's kind of designed itself around ballet. And, you know, Matt and I both absolutely loved Bound when it was released last year. Highly experimental little platformer. The game itself was probably less of an impact as the actual balletic themes that were running through it, the movement of the character, the kind of dance-like style to the platforming and so on. So, yeah, we thought we'd just talk about, you know, some of the games that we like that have pulled elements from other genres of art. And, you know, what we'd like to see, I guess, developers do more of in the future. So, yeah, I mean, Matt, we'll start with you. Bound, you know, we obviously like Bound, but are there other examples of games that, you know, take those kind of high concepts and pull them into games that you can think of off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, there are quite a lot of games that I really like fairy tales, and there are a lot of games that incorporate sort of those familiar fairy tale characters in very different and unusual and interesting ways. I think what immediately comes to mind is Capcom's fighting game Darkstalkers, which all the characters are based on sort of classical monsters, like zombies and werewolves and stuff. But there's one character called BB Hood in the English version, or Bulleter in the Japanese version, who's based on Little Red Riding Hood. But if Little Red Riding Hood was a monster hunter with like every gun you can ever imagine in her little picnic basket, bending the laws of time and space to fit giant rocket launchers and stuff in there. It's a very just bizarre, and that whole game is a very underrated fighting game series. But yeah, there are a lot of games that incorporate sort of Red Riding Hood and Snow White and all these familiar stories that we've grown up with and do interesting things with that.
Have you played The Path, Matt?
I have not, but it's been on my list of these are games I should play for many, many years. To go back to talking about Yoko Taro being a mad genius, I'm really looking forward to his new upcoming mobile game, Sinnoh Alice, which it's only been announced quite recently, so there's not a lot of information about how it'll actually play. It's probably going to be a very typical sort of mobile gacha RPG sort of thing. But most of the main characters there are, again, based on fairy tales and very creative, interesting takes on those characters. So, yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Sure. In a slightly similar-ish topic, I guess, you know, looking at, you know, fairy tales as examples of children's literature, another great classic children's literature classic book is Alice in Wonderland. Mm-hmm. And a couple of developers have taken, you know, shots at the Alice character and done some interesting things with Ginny, I know you've got some pretty strong thoughts about what America McGee did with Alice.
So I was a bit of an Alice nut. Well, I kind of met like a fairy tale nut. Like, I really enjoyed stuff like Fables, for example, and then correspondingly enjoyed the Telltale game, The Wolf Among Us. And so basically when I was growing up, I used to read a lot. And I think as I got older, and my sort of favorite stories like Alice in Wonderland stayed the same, but I sort of wanted like a more mature slash a more relatable take on it. Not to say that obviously American McGee's Alice was relatable in any way, but I just think that, like, especially I remember reading a series of fairy tales. So I think someone had, the name escapes me now, but there was an author, and she basically redone classic fairy tales, sort of updated them into like a sort of more macabre slash 21st century version. The name escapes me. I'm sure I'll remember at some point. But after reading sort of like that particular series of short stories of how she, you know, sort of spun Alice in Wonderland and Beauty and the Beast and sort of like 21st century, I would say, quote unquote, darker stories, I would definitely say that American McGee's Alice is kind of like top up on that list. I mean, if you think about it, I think at its core, it's like a horror action game, you know, and it's definitely an interesting take on Alice in Wonderland. I think what I really enjoyed about this game was not so much the mechanics of the game. It was a bit clunky. I mean, I'm looking at you, EA, but you know, it was a little bit clunky to play. But I think what really sort of drew me in was the reimagining of Alice. So somehow someone had taken the story and a character that, you know, I'd grown up with as a kid, I really loved her, and it made sense. Like, even though you basically flipped her motivations and her world and her backstory upside down, I think what's really important when games adapt from source material that I would suppose you would call unconventional or sort of like removed from how the game plays, like, you know, like, for example, a children's fairy tale to like a really dark sort of like horror action game, I think what's important when you're adapting source material is that it still stays relatable, it's still recognizable, and it's very strong thematically in terms of its link to the original source material. And that's sort of why I enjoyed American McGee's Alice, I think, the most out of the other Alice adaptations, is because it was so recognizably so Alice in Wonderland, just completely topsy-turvy, which in a sense is kind of what happens in Alice in Wonderland, the story, like a regular girl gets her life turned upside down. And I think that maintaining the thematic link in American McGee's Alice was really important to my enjoyment of it.
Yeah, it's funny. You just sidetrack a little bit, but you mentioned EA managing to screw up everything. I was actually at an event. It was really interesting when EA was promoting the game in the lead up to its launch. It actually did a joint event because it was also working on Goichi Suda's Shadows of the Damned at that point in time. And it was just that really interesting kind of clash of different approaches to horror. Alice, you know, is that kind of classy. It was a classy kind of, you know, of horror in the way it was designed. And then Goichi Suda's Shadows of the Damned was obviously this grindhouse inspired, you know, punk rocky style horror. And it was really interesting. I almost wish a different publisher that might have been a bit more hands-off had let those two go and really develop their ideas, because I got the sense with both games that the creator was just a little bit silenced, the creative input from them. And, yeah, there was probably more potential in those games than was kind of realised in the end result. To what you were talking about, Ginny, one of the interesting things, I think, when developers try and take these kinds of outside influences and putting them into games, is doing so in a way that's kind of relatable to people who aren't as familiar with those original works. To go back to, I guess, my original point, the couple of times, for example, that developers have tried to take opera as a theme and work with that in games, to games kind of bring to mind Knights of Azure from Koei Tecmo last year. Was a game that was very kind of operatic in design. And then back on the PlayStation 2, there was a game called Chaos Legion, which Capcom produced, and it kind of got lost very quickly and dismissed as a an inferior take on the whole Devil May Cry style of gameplay. When in reality, it was its own game, and it had very strong ideas, and it executed on those ideas very well. It was just lost a little bit. I think the reason that some of those games get lost is because, I mean, especially when you're looking at opera or ballet or Shakespeare, you know, any of those kind of high art concepts, a lot of people who play games aren't very familiar with those concepts, which makes it very hard for them to relate to the game unless the game somehow manages to explain the entire art movement at the same time it's kind of trying to tell its own story and be its own thing. So I think it's difficult for developers to do that, and as difficult as it is, I kind of hope that they don't stop, because I hope that, you know, these kinds of games inspire people to look at some of the less commonly known, I guess, art movements out there.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Knights of Azure, because I was one of those many people who played it and didn't like it.
Oh, yes, I remember that. We had a big fight about that.
Yeah, we did. We almost stopped being friends. But I think a lot of that is just because I have no familiarity whatsoever with opera, and so none of those themes, I guess, kind of resonated with me. But I think since reading your review and talking to you about it, I've kind of retroactively developed a bit more of an appreciation for the game, and I guess how it's approached adapting that movement. And without going too deep into, I haven't been started doing a PhD in opera or anything, but I think it's a difficult line to balance between.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the point. I mean, a game developer shouldn't be relying on journalists to write articles explaining the influences of the game to an audience in order for the audience to kind of get what the game's on about. So I definitely think that Knights of Azure failed in the sense that it didn't explain its influences well enough or make them relatable enough to people to kind of get where the game was coming from. But again, I mean, how do you make opera relatable to people? And how do you explain to them why opera is cool if they've never been to an opera before? It's a difficult one, and I can certainly see why a lot of developers haven't tried to do, you know, haven't tried to take Hamlet and turn it into a game, or haven't tried to take, you know, Swan Lake and take the basic ideas of Swan Lake and turn them into a game. It's just a very difficult thing to do, and it's not surprising to me that, you know, Tom Clancy is much more popular for game developers, or, you know, whatever other. Or Game of Thrones, or whatever other kind of trash fiction you want to think about or talk about. You know, they're much easier because they're much more relatable. They're very simple stories, very easy to cut and paste into game form.
I'm just going to stop you there and say that actually Hamlet has been adapted into a video game, which came out in 2010 for mobile, and it's called, the full title is Hamlet or the Last Game Without MMORPG Features, Shaders and Product Placement. It's a game about a scientist who travels back in time and gets mixed up with characters from William Shakespeare's play.
There is actually, I do lie, there is a take on Hamlet out there in video games. It's called Ryan North's To Be or Not To Be. It's a visual novel, and it kind of satirizes Hamlet as much as it kind of is a homage to it, and it looks at how Shakespeare pulled his stories together. It kind of highlights various issues around how Shakespeare portrayed women, etc., which is perfectly legitimate criticism of Shakespeare, must be said. But you know, I was talking more about games that actually had production budgets and weren't pulled together on, you know, $2.50.
I think the point I was getting to, and you've kind of touched on that nicely actually, is that I One of my favorite movies of all time is 10 Things I Hate About You,
Oh, yes.
which is an adaptation of Taming of the Shrew, but with a kind of turned it into a like high school teen romance flick from the 90s. Doing so, it managed to make a play that is probably quite obscure to modern day teenagers, take that and make it relevant, but also, again, explore those themes and also critique the original work. And that's something I would really like to see happen more in games, because there's a lot of, you have the kind of niche arty games that kind of try to earnestly adapt things for a niche audience, and then you have the blockbusters that go and do Tom Clancy stuff, and there's I think there's a big gap there missing for games to take those influences and I guess broaden their appeal.
Yeah, for sure. And not that I'm a game developer, but there are certain Shakespeare players, since we're talking about him, that I think would work in games. Macbeth springs to mind immediately. Do Macbeth well in a game and you've got something pretty cool. And yeah, I can see why developers don't want to take on that kettle of fish, because amongst other things, it requires a pretty deep knowledge of storytelling. And without trying to offend anyone too much, I don't think a lot of game developers have that talent on board to do it. But yeah, I think we'll see more of it as the game industry develops further. I mean, if we can have Yoko Taro running around doing all kinds of weird stuff with Jean-Paul Sartre, it's only a matter of time before other developers jump in as well. And yeah, it'll be a good thing, because any of the other arts out there, cross-pollinates with one another quite well. You've got literature that constantly references back to opera and theatre and all that, and you've got films like 10 Things I Hate About You, which most people who watch wouldn't even realize they're getting a Shakespearean education while they're watching that one. Most of them are just watching Heath Ledger sing weird songs, which was cool. Miss Heath. Welcome back. So it is the first week of March, and as long-term listeners, I know there's thousands of you out there, would know at the start of each month we kind of talk about the games that we'll be playing through the month. And it's March, and March is for us game journalists, this March anyway, is just absolutely terrifying because there's no end of them. Yeah, there's just no end of them. I'm just thinking back of the stuff I've got to play right now for review, and I'm just intimidated. So just to quickly go through some of them in the next, well, obviously Nintendo Switch is out now, which means Zelda's out, and everybody's playing that, and it's getting good reviews. Horizon released a couple of days ago, and people who couldn't be bothered getting a Switch will be playing that, thinking they've got a game that's as good as Zelda, when it's really not. But it's pretty. You get to take for nice photos. And then we've got Nier Automata, which we've already talked about. That's out this week. We've got Danganronpa 1 and 2 Edition, which for people who haven't got a Vita, which is most of you, that's a game you should be playing.
Yes.
There's Atelier Ferris, and as the world's biggest Atelier fan, the fact I forgot that shows just how much stuff is coming this month. It kind of came out the end of last month, but it's new now, and that's Planescape Torment's spiritual successor, Tides of Numeria, or however you pronounce it. And it's pretty amazing itself. And that's just this week. So for the rest of the month, there's still a lot more stuff coming out. And Ginny, what are you looking forward to playing, or putting on your backlog more accurately?
Well, I definitely still have to play Nier Automata, so that's gonna sort of skyrocket to the top of my list. And then there's also ME Andromeda, which is gonna be
See, I
big
forgot
on
about
there.
Mass Effect.
Yeah, I was like waiting, and I was like, I'm sure he's gonna say it at some point. But yeah, there's ME Andromeda. I think I'm thinking of, I guess, releases now. Danganronpa 1 and 2 Reload, yes. And I don't know if many people are going to be putting this on their list, but Styx, Shards of
Oh,
Darkness.
yes. Yes. Yes.
Oh, okay,
One of the
great.
most underrated games. I mean,
The last
the
time.
stealth game, that was
Yeah,
better than
exactly.
Thief,
Yeah,
and
the Goblin
Dishonored and
Stealth
whatever
game.
that was
Yeah.
in there.
So
Yeah, that's awesome.
that's good because normally when I say Styx, I'm met with repulsion and booze. But so I'm glad that you guys also appreciate Styx. So yeah, I guess in terms of games that I am thinking of getting my hands on as well, I don't know if anyone else has played this. Maybe me saying that I've played this might expose me for but Senran Kagura.
Yay!
I don't know if the reaction is going to be yay for most people listening. If you don't know what it is, you can look it up. Please don't judge me. Oh, who am I kidding? It's out there anyway. So I think this is Estival Versus, which is coming out. So it is going to be it's kind of like a ninja action game, like well, action game, fighting game. Oh, how do I describe this? Someone's never sort of like put their hands on it before. Well, are we familiar with the Dead or Alive
Of course we are.
series?
This is
Anyone?
digitally downloaded.
Okay, to the listeners, Dead or Alive, but instead of the volleyball game, it's kind of like the island fighting games with shinobi girls. So before I sort of sound too pervy, I'm gonna like try and cut myself off here. But yeah, so I'm looking at trying that out. It will probably be harder for me to get. I'll probably have to order it from Singapore, like I do for most of my games that are from Japan and some Chinese releases too. So I know Tokiden 2 is out. In terms of my enthusiasm about Tokiden 2. One was all right, but I think that's kind of, I'm kind of a sucker for games like that, so I'll probably check it out. Games that I'm not gonna check out, I don't know if this probably wasn't in the brief, but so games that I probably am not gonna look at, Kingdom Hearts HD 1.5 and 2.5 Remix, I'm gonna, give that one a hard pass. Dark Souls DLC probably as well, just because I've heard so much about Neo being, the new reigning king of Dark Souls, so I'll be shelving Dark Souls 3's DLC for a bit. And yeah, I think, am I missing anything out that you guys are into? You guys are looking at trying out?
I think you've pretty much covered everything, but Matt, I know you'll be very excited about Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon Wildlands.
Oh yes, it's still my beating heart.
Yeah, I think.
No, look, even by Tom Clancy standards, that one looks terrible, frankly. I have no interest in that at all. And like when they're making big announcements about bringing screenwriters on, like 1 week before the game's actually due for finish, that kind of tells me everything I need to know about the interest that they've got in the storytelling of that game. So yeah.
And they made a big deal about getting the Die Hard director to direct a trailer for the game,
yes.
Which is, I think it's one thing to get a well-known director to work on the game itself, but celebrating their work on the marketing material seems a bit strange. But yeah, I think you've both kind of covered everything that I am looking forward to. Tokiden 2 is one that I'm really excited about because I really enjoyed the first game. Coming from a place of having tried Monster Hunter lots of times and liking the idea of it, but never really being able to actually get into it, I found that Tokiden Kiwami was the one I played, the remake for PS4. I found that kind of captured the idea of Monster Hunter, but in a way that was more accessible and engaging, I guess. And from everything I've seen for Tokiden 2, it looks like more of the same in a good way.
I think for just about him, I think it's probably, I'm much the same as you. I'm not a huge fan of Monster Hunter, I must admit, but I really got into Tukenen because I think it is the narrative context of those games. It's a little bit like Neo, actually, compared to Dark Souls. The Dark Souls obviously has really strong narrative, but the way that Koei Tecmo manages to take these genres and add a kind of Japanese narrative to the mix kind of works for me. So I can't believe I forgot to get into was this month. Again, bloody March. Can I just say, Nintendo picked the wrong month to release the Switch.
Yeah.
If there was any month where people had an excuse not to buy a Switch, it was this one.
Yeah.
And Atlas had since moved Persona 5 to April. So
yeah, that's
Nintendo
right.
should have done that as well.
I was very much looking forward to Switch, and even when they first did the big live stream thing in January and everyone was being a downer on it and talking about how bad it was going to be, I was in the little corner with like two other people being like, it looks really cool, guys. And I had been planning on getting one at launch, and then as we came closer to March and just looking at everything that was happening, it was just like, there's so much going on. I'm not, even if I buy one now, well, I can't afford it, but even if I did buy one, I wouldn't have time to actually play it because of everything else that there is. So I think that is, yeah, not a great idea for Nintendo to do that. I know, Matt, you have got yours already and have been playing it. How are you finding it?
Yeah, like it's really cool. I see it as a handheld now that I've actually been playing it, and I've played with it on both the TV and the handheld. It is a handheld. I don't see myself actually even bothering hooking it up to my TV for the most part, because the console is clearly not up to the standards of the other ones out there in terms of its ability to produce, you know, big screen entertainment. The PlayStation 4 kind of will still dominate from that point of view. But as a handheld, it's got some really cool ideas. The ability to take the joysticks out and then play some kind of, you know, multiplayer Bomberman or whatever on the go, if you're on the plane or whatever, is a really nice little feature. And the obviously Zelda looks absolutely stunning on the Switch's tablet screen thing. I'm just imagining the next time I get on the train and pull this thing out, I imagine that some people will be more than a little bit curious about it. It's not a very private console if you are playing it in public because of that screen and it's really well lit screen, so everybody's going to be able to see what you're playing. If they happen to release Dead or Alive or Senran Kagura on the Switch at some point, do not play on the train because you might get yelled at for being a pervert. Which has happened to me in the past for Vita games. I must. As a Star Trek. I was playing Dead or Alive.
We've all been there.
I was playing Dead or Alive on the Vita once, and people were calling me a pervert and stuff on the train, which was not very nice. Anyway, the Switch is it's good. Will it be good in the long term? That's probably the big question Nintendo needs to answer. I will say that it has a better launch library of software than people gave it credit for. A lot of people are looking at the retail releases, which is like, what, two or three? Bomberman, 1-2 Switch, and Zelda. But if you go into the actual eShop, there's a bunch of retro games there from, I think it's Neo Geo. I may be wrong there. One of the old arcade consoles. There's a whole bunch of kind of smaller games that are already there that kind of cover off various niches. There's Voez, which is one of the best rhythm games that you'll play on iPhone. It's a free-to-play game, and it's really nasty on the microtransactions. In this one, it's the 418 songs unlocked for the upfront price of under $30. So it's definitely the better version of that particular game, and it is a really good rhythm game. It's probably the best rhythm game that doesn't have Hatsune Miku in it. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's a little bit disappointing that the Switch released in March because I didn't get as excited about it as I might have if I wasn't playing 3 billion other games, including Nier as well. Funny story was I didn't even realize that I'd missed the launch, the midnight launch. I went along to pay off my pre-order a day after the midnight launch, and then the lady went back and got my console. I'm like, what? I'm getting it early. And then I looked at the thing and it's like, oh, the midnight launch was last night. So that's kind of indicative of where the Switch sits with me. It's good hardware. I'm enjoying it. I'm looking forward to seeing what Nintendo does with it. But gosh, they picked the wrong time of the year to release it.